For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's event. My name is Scott Paith. I'm the director of the Center for Interreligious Engagement here at DePaul University. And it's my pleasure to welcome you here this afternoon. The Center for Interreligious Engagement was organized to bring together people who are interested in carrying on conversations about religious difference and inclusion in the pluralistic society in which we live today. Our mission has been to create a forum for the creation of an interreligious engagement both within the DePaul community, throughout the city of Chicago, and in conversation with the pressing issues of religious diversity throughout the world. The primary way that we do this is through speakers and events that we organize here at DePaul. Let me just mention briefly, we've got a number of events in the works for winter and spring, including a discussion about how atheists and people of faith can have a conversation together, an event on overcoming religious bigotry and Islamophobia, and also we're working on a possible film series. Meanwhile, we also have in the spring Buddhist speaker Thubten Chodron, and another event that will feature Catholic theologian Peter Fahn in conversation with Professor Reuven Firestone, an expert on Judaism and Islam, who teaches at the University of Southern California. So these are some of the events that we have going on in the winter and spring quarters, and hopefully we'll get on our mailing list, and we will ensure that as those events come down the pike, you will be notified about them. To introduce our speaker today, I would like to introduce Taigen Layton of the Ancient Dragon Zen Temple here in Chicago, who will be making the introduction.
Thank you. Oops, touch it. Okay. Thank you very much, Scott. I'm very honored to be introducing Peter Coyote today. I'm Taigen Layton from the Ancient Dragon Zen Gate Temple on Irving Park Road in Chicago. And Peter and I practiced together at San Francisco Zen Center in the late 70s and early 80s. He's been doing Buddhist practice for a long time. He's now an ordained Zen priest and preparing for Dharma transmission to be authorized teacher. But he's already a teacher. He's already a very skillful speaker about Buddhist issues. So, you know, that's part of what he will be speaking about today. Peter is also a longtime activist. He helped to really start the student protest movement in the early 60s, going to Washington, D.C. to protest nuclear armaments, and was actually part of a group that was brought into the White House. He's maintained his activism, social justice and peace and environmental activism all this time. He was one of the founders of the Diggers in the late 60s in Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco, who helped provide food and medicine and housing for people coming to San Francisco with flowers in their hair and so forth. So he also has been worked with Governor Jerry Brown in California for the California Arts Council and helped to develop that program quite a lot in California. He's been active in many aspects of social justice work, including working with Native Americans and is a friend of Leonard Peltier, still imprisoned, and continues to be active and involved in peace work. Aside from that, some of you may know of him as a film actor. He's been in many, many films. A Man in Love, Bitter Moon, A Walk to Remember, Time Rider, E.T., some of you may remember, and Aaron Brockovich, just a short part of the long list. Peter also, of course, you'll all recognize his voice from many, many documentaries, including the wonderful series that Ken Burns did on the Roosevelts recently. So I'm very happy to be introducing Peter Coyote, and please enjoy him. Thanks. Thank you all very much.
today's little talk on Hollywood sex practices. I'm very sorry, that's tomorrow's lecture. I say that because, you know, even for me, an actor giving a talk about something serious, it's a little bit like Samuel Johnson's talking dog. It's not that he does it well, but that he does it at all. But I'm hoping to beg enough mercy that I've actually been doing Zen practice for over 40 years, and I'm a writer, and although I'm very grateful to movies and the entertainment industry for getting my children through school debt-free and buying houses for two wonderful women, it was really how I made my living. It's a slow group. It was how I made my living, and where I really lived was as a writer and as a Buddhist practitioner. So today's talk is really entitled Punching Through the Invisible, because I changed it from the title that they posted to make it even more inscrutable. But it basically begins to answer a question, which is, can spiritual practices be of any use in resolving the kind of obdurate problems that are tying up the nation and gridlocking the Congress and freezing all civil discourse? Can they be of any use to that? And if not, why am I pursuing them? And if so, why isn't everybody pursuing them? So I don't want you to think that this is a completely worked out thesis. I'm taking a stance that yes, they can, and they do, and I'm inviting you to join a colloquy with me about how we can do that, in which each person will bring their own kind of creative response. The purpose of my talk today is to try to set a frame and look at the subject a little differently. So, imagine that your house was on fire, and the firemen come rushing up to put out your house, and suddenly a county official comes and says, "I'm very sorry, the hose you were using is no longer in specification." And another one comes up and says, "The nozzle is not no longer legal." And so somebody else comes up, an importer, and he says, "I can get you a Chinese hose that will fit the standards that you need, and I can get it for 60% less than what you're currently using." At which point a union representative comes up and says, "If you buy a hose from the Chinese that is not made in a union shop, we're going to sue you." And, you know, on and on and on it goes while the house continues to burn. And this little analogy kind of mimics the gridlock of contemporary political life. The house is our planet. The intervening officials represent the varying lobbying groups, merchants, political interests, employment opportunities, and ideological fixations that have created impasses every time we try to come to a decision, no matter how critical. All these things stop and just turn everything to jello and nothing moves. So let's also assume for a minute that none of the individuals that came forward were venal, that none of them were being, you know, really fiendishly evil, but that perhaps they were simply pursuing an agenda with a very restricted frame and a very tight focus, and their crime, if there was any, was that they didn't pay any attention to the larger field. They just went to work, they had a job to do, the union guy's job is to represent members and seek their well-being, and the county official's job is to make sure that the law is being followed. But nobody in their job description has the responsibility for looking at the larger field. Well, such failures of perspective and scope are direct byproducts of the way that we think about reality. We hold ideas about reality, and these ideas create a kind of invisible frame around subjects. And these frames actually exclude certain possibilities. We can't discuss them because we can't really see them. They, you know, for instance, a statement like, "We need a balance between business and the environment." That's a frame. And such a frame completely ignores the fact that the environment is the set of all sets, and the business is a subset of it. And elevating it to parity creates a false equality that freezes the issue. And thus, we lose wetlands, we lose pure water, we lose species, we lose what? That's just a simple example. So the real question might be, how must businesses operate so as not to harm the environment? That would be an open-ended discussion into which many, many people could contribute, but it's not based on a false equivalency. It repeats the actual hierarchical relationship that exists that a number of nameless interests choose to ignore. So, two narratives about reality tend to dominate our perception. Our five senses deliver us a world in which apparently everything is discrete. Every snowflake, every grain of sand, every human being, every animal is a unique experience, a unique entity. And this is our Western European view of normal. And because it's based on separate and independent integers, I'm just going to refer to it in shorthand as the independent. An equally true and contrasting alternative posits that the entire universe is one kind of interdependent blob. We can start even with the orbit of Earth around the sun. If we were any closer, water would freeze and life as we know it wouldn't be here. It would burn off. If we were any farther away, water would freeze. So starting from there, our entire existence of everything on Earth is dependent on the orbit of the planet Earth in space. But then you go farther. There's not one of us who has ever been independent of sunshine, ever been independent of water, ever been independent of pollinating insects, microbes in the soil which break down the minerals so that plants can absorb them, ever independent of the people who plant, grow, pick, harvest, mill, weave, and sew our clothing, and on and on and on until we have the entire universe as one interdependent blob. It's true. It's contradictory to our commonsensical view, which is also true. So the two perspectives are competitive. Well, they're not actually competitive, but they're like heads and tails on a coin. And we shouldn't be forced to choose, because each one contains a set of truths that are not in the other. I mean, it is true that the world is, reality is one big interdependent blob, but if you adhere to that worldview too rigidly and solely, individual people become very unimportant. It's easy to say, well, we might lose 2 million, but this is for the greater good. And if you adhere only to the independent, it's very tough to make actions accountable to the biosphere or to the larger picture. So this humans obviously experience a sense of self within that independent worldview. We all have an idea that we exist. We all have an idea that we're separate from the rest of it. And while that's indisputably true, it's not indisputably true that our self exists the way we think of it. If you look at the interdependent, it proves to you that our self is not a little kernel that's tucked behind your gallbladder with your name on it. You may have an implied center from your five senses and your body, thoughts, impulse, sensations, and consciousness, but you can't describe to me the shape of yourself. You can't describe its color. You can't describe where it's located. So if I were a used car salesman and I were trying to sell you a car, that I couldn't describe the model, the color, the brand, or where it was parked, you wouldn't give me much credence. And yet, with this sort of self we all perceive, we fight to the death for our prejudices, for our beliefs, for the way we see things. And when we look at the world from that point of view, we are, in effect, half right. But we're also half wrong. So these two points of view regard the same world. When we look at the world from the point of view of the absolute or the interdependent, we are half right. but we're half wrong. And the areas in which we are half wrong are the shadows of each worldview. They're the places from which unintended consequences emerge. They're the consequences of going into a country like Iraq with no idea of the difference between Sunnis and Shias, and no idea of what the consequences would be of letting civil society be completely destroyed, letting the museums be looted, the culture be looted, failing to guard even the uranium dumps, guarding only the oil. I'm not saying it's evil, but I'm saying it's the shadow side of great intelligence and planning. Now, each of these worlds has a kind of dominant mental track. The world of the everyday, the independent, is kind of governed by intelligence, because intelligence is this great reductive analytical force, problem-solving force. And because it's so useful to us, because it's given us our wealth and our leisure time and our health and our medicines and our toys and all that we like, we really privilege it. We name our favorite products after it. Smartphones, smart cars, smart cameras, what have you. But there is a problem with it, and that is that intelligence has no moral valence. Intelligence can build a hospital, or it can build a concentration camp. It can build a medicine, or it can build a bioterror weapon. It's equally as useful to a drug lord, a smuggler, a sex slaver, or a president. So it has a shadow side, which we tend not to look at. A study was once done where people said pessimists tend to be more accurate in their predictions than optimists, but people always follow optimists. As we know, there are grave consequences from not paying attention to shadows. So the other point of view, the holistic point of view, the interdependent, is kind of ruled by intuition. And intuition is a far older mental process than intelligence. And it's made up of intelligence and memory and emotion. And it gives us the idea of accessing vast areas of the brain almost simultaneously with the speed of thought. And it produces very direct actional impulses. Maybe some of you read a couple of years ago, there was a big firefight in California, and a bunch of firefighters were trapped on a hill, a grassy hill, and a fire was in a canyon sweeping up toward them, and they were trapped. There was no way they were going to get away. They were going to die. And one of the fellows counterintuitively lit a match and lit the grass around him and burned a clear space in which he lay down, and those of his friends who copied him survived. Could never have reasoned it out. It happened under great pressure, and he did it. So these two points of view regard the same world, and then we funnel both these points of views through another mechanism, which helps us a great deal. It offers us a great phenomenal tool. It's ironic that I'm going to talk about it, but it's language. And for all of the gifts that language gives us, it enacts a cost that we never look at. So the cost is that we tend to confuse words with things. If I say to you tree, you get an image of what that word means, whatever you associated with that word. And it's easy. It's easy to cut down a tree. There are millions of them. You can do that. But that word also limits all the tangible relationships that a tree has. It doesn't describe the trees holding water and sinking it into the aquifers. It doesn't describe the trees housing bird populations, insect populations, predator and prey populations. And so it's much easier to cut down a tree than it is to attack the entire web of life. And so when we operate from the point of view of language, we get great power, we get great access, we get great facility. That might be my agent calling. We get great facility, but we also lose something, because language is really the province of the independent. And we don't have many things to remind us of that. So there's a phrase in Japanese, I don't speak Japanese, but the phrase, when it's translated into English, It is one board fellow. And the image is of a guy carrying a wide board on his shoulder as he walks through the street. And he can see everything on this side, and he can see nothing on this side. And language makes of us all one board fellows. And choosing one of these points of view, the independent or the interdependent, and favoring it makes of us all one board fellows. And one board fellows is the simplest shorthand, perhaps, to describe the failings of the executives and the county officials and all the people that were in that early analogy of our house being on fire. So we can say the same thing about words like liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican. They all excite images in our mind, but we have no certainty that the image that I hold of the word conservative is the image that you hold of the word conservative, or the image I hold of the word liberal or Democrat is the same, and yet we talk about them as if they were tangible objects like this thing. And millions of dollars are spent on airtime and TV time, and people are describing their personal associations with these images as if they were actual facts. And these things generate incredible energy and cost on the world. So our inability to unify these two views, the independent and the interdependent, thank you so much. I really need this. Thanks. Pause. Our inability to unify and fuse these two views, which are held apart, among other things, by language, may be the simplest reason why every culture on earth has developed spiritual practices. And these spiritual practices, which are varied, they may be song, they may be prayer, they may be fasting, they may be ayahuasca, they may be peyote, but they're all basically designed to suspend that separation and to get back to that primordial feeling of wholeness that perhaps we once felt as children. Some way to recapture this sense of being, you know, crippled by only having one arm or one language or one point of view to which we favor. So, that's part one. I said this, a little out of order. I said this. Okay, so does this separation mean that human beings are going to be perpetually condemned to fumble our attempts to resolve the most important issues in our lives? Yes, it does. It means that we are going to continually fail at perfectly solving the most complex problems. But that doesn't mean that we have to leave ourselves vulnerable to nuclear catastrophe or, some other horrific imagining. We actually have skills and tools that we can bring to bear that we don't, and that's what I'd like to talk about next. So, a substantial part of all of our current political and social dilemmas come about, according to my thesis, to human beings ignoring an asset that we all have, which is part of the human birthright that we either forget, haven't been told we have, or ignore. I call it wisdom. And I would say that what it really is the ability that many, many nations, cultures, religions have practiced over the years of maintaining some parallel semblance of both perspectives, the independent and the interdependent, at the same time. It's a trick. It's hard, but it can be done. And by oscillating back and forth between them, you actually diminish the number of shadows when you're involved, when you're investigating any area. Because when you're in the independent and you go to consult the interdependent, you see the shadow sides that are left out of the independent's assessment. And the same is true on the other side. But people tend to feel more comfortable being with one or the other. But that is not where wisdom is. So it is wisdom and neither intelligence nor intuition alone that's going to save us. And so my working definition of wisdom is the ability to access both. Doesn't have to be simultaneous. In my practice, we sort of go back and forth. We meditate between them. So had the policemen and the county officials and all those people, had they suspended their personal goals long enough to assess the entire situation, they might have determined that the first order of priority was putting out the fire. And once the fire was out, we had a much longer timeline in which to discuss the right hose, the right nozzle, where it was going to be bought, and how much we're going to be paid for it. But that focus of applying intelligence through strategy to solving a problem and never consulting the larger context cost us the house. The situation is identical when we address real-world problems like global warming or pollution, whose effects occur over too long a time scale to trigger immediate threat warnings. Every climatologist on the planet, 1,800 and something climatologists, save those who work for the American Petroleum Institute, are telling us that we are burning the planet alive. We've already passed the 2 degrees, the 2% increase in carbon every year into our environment. And we're looking at a 6 or 7 degree rise in temperature, which according to NASA, not hippie Phil over here, but NASA, is going to cause between 60 and 80 foot sea rises in the next century. Well, that's going to mean not the death of humankind, but the death of civilization. Because when billions of people around the coasts of India and China and Miami and Texas, when they're all forced inland in huge mass migrations, there is no government in the world that will be stable enough to resist that. And as the fresh water gets filled by salt water, as the freshwater aquifers get invaded by salt water, water itself is going to be a precious commodity, and there is going to be no substitute for water, ever. And we are fooling around. We're still advertising 600 horsepower cars. If you have enough money, you can go out and buy a 600 horsepower Ferrari. And if you have enough money, you can buy a 400 horsepower Chrysler. And now we're watching the news every day, and we're watching ISIS behead Americans, all because 10 years ago, we could not get it together to start a Manhattan Project to say, come on, folks, this is the smartest, most adept, adroit nation on earth. We can get off domestic oil. We can get off the use of oil in a decade. And had we done that, we would not be expending our lives and treasure, sending troops to die and be maimed in the Middle East. But all of us go because we can't see the threat. The politicians who are in power now have figured accurately that they will be dead and gone before the consequences come true, but they will have held power until they died. And there's no national dialogue, there's no debate in which to hold the largest context. There's guys like me and Tygan and thousands screaming on our blogs, but we are so out of the mainstream. And then there are full-time propaganda organs like Fox News, which are deliberately denying science and obfuscating the issues and creating doubt. And meanwhile, we're like Icarus sailing into the sun. So, my personal spiritual practice is Zen Buddhism, and it involves daily meditation and periodic intensives where you meditate from 5 in the morning till 9:30 or 10 at night with little breaks so you don't lose your legs and so you can keep your energy up. So I'm not arguing for one moment that Zen practice has the lien on wisdom. Zen practice is one of the myriad ways of getting to wisdom. But the way we do it is interesting. When we sit, when we meditate, the first thing you'd notice is we sit upright. We don't favor the independent. We don't favor the interdependent. We don't lean forward into our problems. We don't lean back away from them. We just sit in what Buddhists call big mind, kind of undifferentiated reality. And by doing this simple practice of just sitting, year after year after year, something happens, something softens, and that supposedly rigid barrier between these two worldviews and perceptions gets semi-permeable. It gets like a colander. So even though when we get up off our pillows, we're just in the regular human realm of everyone else, we carry some notion with us of the larger picture, some notion that informs our plans and our thinking. And it's this sense of this duality. Christians have many traditions that do this. Indians have many traditions that do this. It's a human birthright. But you know, when you're shouting and when you're playing with your iPhone all the time and you're watching television and you're entertaining yourself all the time, it's hard to hear the little whispers. I just watched a documentary film about people in China who take apart the computer garbage that we send over there. They're dying of cancer at 12 and 13 years old. They're stripping our old computers for copper wire, taking it apart, burning the plastic. The kids are playing in black plumes of smoke. And we're sending it over as a toxic gift to kill these people. I don't believe there's a single person in this room that would do that, to save maybe the $5 it might add to the price for the manufacturers of computers to take them back and be responsible for them, recycling the mercury, recycling the copper. But with nobody looking at the larger picture, there's no way to solve that problem. Mercury and television screens. It's not so difficult to collect an old TV when you buy a new one, but there's no big picture to do that. So acknowledging moving back and forth between the independent and the interdependent reminds us of that. It will show us, okay, here's my TV. I'll take it out to the dump. Oh, interdependent. Where does it go from the dump? What does it do? Does it decompose? We're sending it to China. What happens to those poor Chinese people? What happens to those poor African people that are getting cancer and dropping dead so I can go on mix and match or meet a mate or whatever it's called? Consider how history might have been different had BP fully considered the implications of an oil spill in the Gulf. I don't know if anyone read Naomi Klein's study. She was traveling with two boats from University of Georgia and University of Florida, the only two colleges that were not taking government money to research damage in the Gulf. And what they found was there at about 3,000 foot level, there's a 35 mile long plume of oil that every whale, every turtle, every shrimp, every piece of krill has to swim through to get to the surface. Meanwhile, you turn on the TV and there are smiling people saying, "We're back. The beaches are clean. Come down to Mississippi. Come to Louisiana. Come on." Well, it's all a scam. It's all to protect business. Short-term investment. Let's make an ad. Let's create a new image. But nobody's looking at the big picture. So I think we have to. And since the Congress has demonstrated that it's incapable of leading a five-man parade, I think that we have to lead. I think that we have to take the responsibility. And when we start doing it, they will follow. I guarantee you. So how could wisdom exert a positive spin? I'd like to talk about a couple of real-world examples or possibilities, because this is where the rubber meets the road. It's easy to theorize. But so let's take one of the environmental efforts that I've been really concerned with for a long time was logging and logging practices and clear-cutting of our ancient forests all over North America and Alaska. So when the country begins to decide that they don't want to do this anymore, we don't want to cut down 2,000-year-old redwood trees, you know, to make a patio for people, certain problems come right to the fore directly. The problems have been quite clear. A century and a half of aggressive extraction has silted streams, completely cut off salmon growth and populations. It has cut down the breeding areas for the salmon. With it have gone the boating industry, the foul weather gear industry, the netting industry, the sonar industry, all these ripple effects. And you have a whole population of people, on the one hand, financial people, who have invested in huge corporations that extract lumber. They have wealth tied up in it. Their personal wealth is based on the value of that stock. And then you have common blue-collar working people who are struggling to educate their kids, get into the middle class, pay for their houses. If you just change policy and you don't make any exception for these people, finance will join with labor and they will create the same kind of deadlock. So how could we use this oscillating back and forth to look at a problem like that? What are we going to do about the problems? So, you know, investment capital controls enormous power, and it's hooked to intelligence to maximize returns on investment. That's what it does. And that strategy does not involve keeping track of the health of the aquifers, the health of the forest, the diminution of other species, the employment possibilities for labor. They just have a very limited goal, like the county official who wants to take the hose away. Forget that the house is burning. Well, it would be simplistic to say stop logging. I just explained why. Owners of capital have choices. They can move their money at will. But what about labor? What about the people who accepted the world as they found it? They were given assurances that this was legal. They did nothing immoral. They did what the government told them was lawful. And now suddenly the government wants to change its mind. Well, it seems to me that the first principle that you have to accept is you have to look at the holistic and you have to say, if you're going to change policy in a drastic and deep way, the first thing you have to do is account for the people who are going to be made the new losers. Because if you don't, they will block you from fulfilling your goals. A few years ago, I was up in Idaho fishing, and I met a bunch of cowboys and ranchers. My dad raised cattle. I grew up ranchers. I like those people. And I was talking to them, or they started talking to me, actually, because they guessed that I would be a fan of wolf reintroduction. And the conversation started off in a really heated way. But when we got down to it, when they relaxed and they saw I wasn't pointing fingers and accusing them, what came out of it was that nobody had asked them about wolf reintroduction. They said, "Don't you think we live here? Don't you think we could have told you where it would have been safe to release wolves and how to do it in a way that would not have imperiled our livelihood?" But because no one did that, because it was a top-down imposition, college-trained ecologists and biologists who looked at the land as if there was no one on it and never consulted those people, the ranchers thought, this is actually a government trick to regulate us off our land, to turn this into national parks so that urban yuppies from California can come backpacking. And I could see how they got there, because they were never included. So, the first advantage that an interdependent review offers is a more advantageous perspective. Let's just take that as a general principle. Yeah, a perspective that will include all stakeholders in a problem and not simply regard the will of the administration in power or the will of financial capital, but to realize whoever you are, whatever your political power, you are in a matrix of interdependence, and the rest of that matrix needs to be consulted. I mean, should loggers be evicted from their homes so that urban backpackers can go through an idea of wilderness in which there were no people? There were never no people. Wilderness was always managed. Native American forests had 40% more nut trees than any other expanses of forest. They burned off the grass under oak trees so that it would be easier to collect the acorns. Certain amazingly productive trees were owned by families. So the idea of getting people out of wilderness and calling it wilderness is a mental pet of the 20th and 21st century. People have always lived and operated within nature, but they didn't always live and operate extractively. They operated interdependently. So, this apparent contradiction between the independent and the interdependent narratives can be resolved at a higher level. For instance, there is a century's work in the nation's forests, using the same people with the same tools in the same forests, pulling up fallen slag timber, repairing and getting rid of unneeded logging roads, cleaning out the creeks and rivers so the salmon can breed in there again, laying down gravel red so they can breed. This work will in turn produce larger salmon runs. It will in turn reinvigorate the boating industry, the canning industry, the sonar industry, the foul weather gear industry. Plenty of opportunities for private capital to prosper. But there's one proviso. Only the government can and will invest in the production of public wealth. No corporation is going to invest in the public wealth. And the problem is that the returns on capital that private capital wants are greater than the reproductive rate of nature. So if you're going to create financial instruments or some way to pay for this process, you have to have biologists working with the financial community to say, oh, okay, so this is the rate at which timber reproduces. So I guess if it's 4%, we can't have a rate of return greater than 4%. We're going to have to find some other way to compensate people for whom the fiscal return is not enough. And we're going to have to offer some advantages to financial capital, which is invested in extractive industries, and the people who have made their living extracting and decimating them, or it won't happen. Environmentalists and biologists currently at loggerheads with most loggers could willingly do this kind of rebuilding of national wealth. And this is our national wealth. Excuse me. Topsoil is our national wealth. Reproductive timber is our national wealth. I'm talking wealth, not riches. Stable employment is a national wealth. Stable communities are a national wealth. Riches are something else altogether. Riches is money, cash, commodities, goods. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. But there's something wrong with it when it violates the set of all sets, which is the environment. So we have a lot of successful models for this kind of organization. We've had AmeriCorps, we've had the WPA, we've had the Peace Corps. It's not like reinventing the wheel. We could do this. I'm not an economist. I actually sent this paper to Robert Reich, and I sent it to Joseph Stiglitz to ask them for help on what the financial models might look like. I imagined something like, e-bonds that would pay for this restorative work. We have to keep the oil in the ground. There's 2,700 gigatons of oil under the Earth's surface, and climatologists tell us if we burn 500 gigatons, we no longer have a planet. So that oil represents the untold wealth of pension funds, investors, personal family fortunes, the capital that rebuilds nations. Ecuador offered their oil to the world. They said, we'll sell it to you at half price and keep it in the ground. And no one stepped forward. So we're going to have to do it, and we're going to have to figure out financial instruments to do it. That's not my pay grade. That's not my skill. I want to introduce the subject. There are probably people in this audience that know how to do that. We have a phrase in Buddhist practice which is really useful. A clay Buddha can't cross water. An iron Buddha can't go through a furnace. And a wood Buddha can't go through a fire. And what it means is that no fixed idea will work in every situation. Liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat. A stopped clock is right twice a day. The world is moving much faster than that. It's much more fluid. And since our leadership is incapable of it, it falls on us to be fluid and to practice this interperspective consultation of wisdom, of moving between the individual and the interdependent. Much prosperity could be generated by targeted public investments, which consider both. I don't know how to do that, but I know it's theoretically possible. Maybe the first guy that thought of human flight didn't know how to do it, but he knew it was possible. And you have to break open the intellectual ground before the theoretical ground and the actual mechanical processes will follow. So it's clear that accepting the relationship between independent activities governed by intelligence and interdependent perceptions governed by intuition will create these new difficulties. Every decision we make is going to create new sets of winners and losers. But we can't stop there. We have to somehow account for them. Maybe they won't get 100 cents on the dollar. But we have to work out something that works for them because our fates are tied together. And treating them like they're expendable has demonstrated it doesn't work. The specific answers to how to do this are less important than my introducing the subject to you. Humans will never be perfect. We will never live in a problem-free environment. Our nature will never be perfect. But considering what might be accomplished by addressing the world as it actually is, meaning both ways of looking at it, may remind us that we're neither helpless nor impotent. We can prioritize our concerns. We can agree to address the house on fire before our personal desires. We have the power to sublimate our personal interests long enough to reduce mortal danger, and at the same time reminding ourselves there will be opportunities later to seek personal gain. This is not food for thought. This is actual nourishment. Living in such a way is actual nourishment. It feels good because you're aligning yourself with the way the universe works. I suspect that others beside myself might be hungry for it. I suspect even an atheist could accept this way of looking at the world and find it useful. I'm anxious to hear what you think. Thank you very much. I'm happy to accept questions from those who are still awake. Yes.
So, two questions. My first question is, you have that long meditation about 12 hours, all you need to describe.
Yes.
And what is the difference internally between this many hours meditation and 30 minutes or whatever you do every day? And second question, when you start doing this meditation, what changes you found in yourself in like a few years or
something? Okay. Did everyone hear his question or should I repeat it? Okay. So he asked me to compare and contrast long, week-long meditations with 30-minute periods. And then he asked me as a subset to tell what I discovered when I began to sit, and I didn't have a lot of cumulative experience. So let me start with that, because when I started 40 years ago, I was just starting. I was actually a drug addict, and I had to take care of my life. I was a single father, and I was in a lot of trouble. And one of the things I did was to break with my environment and the people that I'd been with as I moved into the neighborhood of a Buddhist monastery, and I started to sit. And so the first thing that I began to experience was actually how busy my mind is. To sit for 30 minutes a day, you are introduced to the full feverish activity of your mind. And most of us have never seen it. And until we see it, we can't really conceive of the utility of calming it down. Because as soon as your thoughts produce that you don't like, you grab a smoke, you look at your iPod, you grab your email. So just making the commitment to sit still and undistracted for 30 minutes a day, the mind begins to slow down on its own. You don't have to slow it down. We're not trying to stop thinking. We're not trying to obliterate the ego. We are trying to be there with our entire self. Our body and mind are just sitting with this experience of being alive and human. And it's a cumulative experience. Believe me, I could never have considered a week-long meditation if I hadn't sat for a year. Now, what did I begin to find? I began to find a feeling of spaciousness. Instead of all of my life and problems being crammed into this little pressure cooker. And every time they came up, I was tormented by something, you know, drugs, the way I'd yelled at my kids, something else I'd done. Somehow when you're on a longer, wider, vaster field, those problems come around more slowly because there's a lot of other stuff. But I want to finish talking to this man. There's a lot of other stuff. And they come around at a speed at which you can begin to handle them. And when you begin to see that, it builds a confidence in the practice itself. It begins a confidence that you actually have skills and you actually have teachers and fellow people you're traveling with, practicing with, to help you. And then in the long, week-long meditations, that's where you have real breakthroughs, where you just sort of exhaust that small self and something else breaks through. And then you go back to your smaller meditations, but it kind of holds the ground there. You don't slip back entirely. You have an idea of something, and it holds it. And so, once again, by going back from the small to the large, the individual to the interdependent, gradually you're able to communicate between them. You had a question.
What do you mean by wood Buddha, and what do you mean by food for thought?
Okay. So a wood Buddha would mean a wooden statue of Buddha, and a bronze Buddha would be a statue made of bronze. If you put a bronze statue through a furnace, it would melt. If you put a clay statue of Buddha in water, it would dissolve. So it's a way of saying nothing will survive every assault. Nothing will be accurate in every situation. And food for thought means something that excites your thinking and nourishes your thinking on a certain subject. Wait, there's other people that were raising their hands. I thought I saw. If not, go. Yes.
You mentioned several times that nobody's looking at the big picture. Isn't it more likely that there are people looking at the big picture, but they're ignoring the big picture and going after their own greedy interests?
Yes. Lots of people are looking at the big picture. That was careless of me. There are a lot of people who are looking at the big picture and who are doing great work and are being ignored. And there are a lot of policymakers and supposed leaders who are looking at the big picture and ignoring it, which is why we have to take back the mantle of leadership. I mean, just look at gay marriage. You know, gay marriage was settled by citizens. It was settled by people having gay nephews and sons and daughters and cousins, and Congress just continued to act cowardly and pander to their voters until one day it was a fait accompli. So it's going to be the same. If we wait, we'll all be charcoal. So I'm just urging you to start at a community level, to find a problem, to take the biggest address to it you can, and to oscillate backwards and forwards without sacrifices, looking at the relationship between the smallest integers and the largest. But thank you for that clarification. I do get carried away. Yes?
Peter, you had asked an intriguing question at the outset, which is, what can the Buddha Dharma contribute to these highly politicized times? And I think we have such a unique group of people here, it'd be worthwhile to explore that. Three things immediately come to mind for me. One would be the Buddhist practice of a right speech and deep listening. And you've been a perfect example of that today. And our Buddhist Peace Fellowship chapter here in Chicago tries to do that by offering things in the spirit of teachings. Another, I think, important Buddhist insight is how suffering can result from misperception. And you've pointed out that several times today, and that's very helpful. But I'm wondering, in your travels, what else have you seen that the Buddha Dharma can offer to the political climate that we're in?
Well, let me just be clear about one thing. I actually didn't say Buddha Dharma. I said spiritual practices, because I wanted to honor the practices of people in this room who are not Buddhists, who are Jews or Hindus or Christians or whatever. So I'm happy to answer that question, but I really believe that all spiritual practices at their root are transcendental and can lead us into the big picture and then lead us to listening to wisdom. I gave a Dharma talk. A Dharma talk is a lecture about Buddha's teachings that that teachers give to my friend Taigen's Zen group today. And one of the things that I pointed out is that we don't meditate to get enlightened. If you meditate to get enlightened, you immediately create two mental constructs. You create an idea of yourself that's over here, and an idea of enlightenment that's over here, and those symbols will never claim. So we sit and we practice meditation, and this is tough for Westerners to accept, but we do it because Buddha told us to. And we do it because for 95 generations there have been living exemplars of what it's like to practice the paramitas of generosity, diligence, giving, support, to actually live as a Buddha. That's the goal. Whether you get enlightenment or not may be insignificant. The reward is living like a Buddha. And Buddha was quite clear. He said, you know, I came to teach one thing, suffering and the ending of suffering. And he wasn't talking about the suffering that comes from an earthquake or your house falling on you. He's talking about the needless suffering we create for ourselves and others. So my experience of the Buddha Dharma has been that it's a very effective mechanism, that living like a Buddha incorporates all these practices of kindness and right speech and generosity. But so do Christian monks. So do Jains. So do Hindus that follow the actual precepts of their faith. So that's why I use the catchphrase, spiritual practices. I've seen, in every Zen center I've gone, I've seen wonderful examples of reaching out to the community, lowering their anxiety by being kind, by being good listeners, taking on helpful tasks, creating hospices, creating charitable works that gradually make them favored citizens in that area. It's very small. But if I think that 50 years ago, a little Japanese man, this big, named Suzuki Roshi, Sunryu Suzuki, came to America and began sitting in a garage by himself. By himself. And in 2014, there are thousands of Zen centers, Buddhist centers in the United States, hundreds of thousands of practitioners. I said today that in 1975, there was a fellow named Prigogine, a Russian, who won the Nobel Prize. And he won the Nobel Prize for discovering that organisms, whether they're single-celled, multi-celled, or even nation-states, when they're perturbed beyond a certain level, they make a kind of quantum leap to a higher level of organization that includes the contradictions. So when I look at a map of the United States, the body politic of the United States, and I think, well, if this was my body, and if each Buddhist center on my body was a spot of cancer, I would not be ignoring it because they were tiny pinhead-sized dots. So I think something is growing in the failures of American culture and American belief. I think this deeper, wider vision of Buddhist perspective is a great tool, but so is Kabbalah. So is Christianity. The Dalai Lama has urged people, if you're Jewish, stay a Jew, practice kindness. If you're a Catholic, stay a Catholic, practice kindness. So while I'm with you in the practice of Buddhism, I didn't want to stress it overly because I didn't want people to feel excluded. Yes, or girls first.
So the body politic is on fire, right? And so, but we know when a house is on fire, people run around really crazy. They get really, like, scared. And there's not a lot of vision at that moment. Or, like, when someone's drowning and you go to rescue them and then you drown, too, because they're flailing around.
That's what happened to one of our Zen teachers.
I'm sorry. Yeah. It's tragic, actually. So I'm in the body politic. And I work politics, and I'm not a Buddhist. And but I really like what you have to say, and thank you. I'm glad to be here today.
Thank you.
So, but my question really is, so I took some notes of what you said. So really the fact is, Republican, Democrat, I don't really care. I really care about how do we create a whole and healthy community. But I would argue and say that the people who are in power today, they're not really listening. And again, isn't it, you have to have the ears to listen, the eyes to see. So with what you're saying today, really, given who's in power, and I am a Democrat, but I think we lost for very good reasons. So my point is, so how would you even create an access point for real change? Like, I'm here because I actually do believe that what you're saying is true. So I'm not questioning that. I'm actually asking, but where would you really get people who are truly in power to start actually listening to create any change like what you're talking about? And I don't know that you have an answer, but
well, I have to ask. I think about it a lot. It's the obvious question to ask somebody who's just spent 40 minutes yammering away on the subject. So one thing is, I spent 8 years working for Jerry Brown during his first term as governor. And I ran a state arts agency, and we had a phenomenal success putting these ideas into practice. Came in with a budget of $1 million a year, ended with a budget of 18, including $2 million of federal money, and were supported and endorsed by Republicans because we honored their concerns. For instance, Republicans did not want to give money to artists. They thought, why should we create artists as a special class of people? I said, I can see that. So what we did was we hired artists under contracts to solve problems for the state. And we sent them into schools, senior citizen centers. We had dancers working with seniors and people with movement difficulties. We had filmmakers making films with high school kids about teenage pregnancy. One of them won 5 Emmys. And they were paid for that. And they got a living wage for half-time work, and they made the art for free. And we had 14 interagency agreements where California state agencies picked up 50% of our budget. And I learned that the hard way. I learned it by being a vicious, potty-mouthed guy who paralyzed the state when I was made chairman and realized that I had to eat crow, apologize, and go to the big picture. And me and my compatriots learned how to do it. And the upshot was, in the year that Prop 13 passed, and every state agency was held at a 10% cut, mine went up 500. And then the next year, it went up 800. And then it kept rising to 16. So I know there's an efficacy in that. So how did we do it? First of all, we did it by being civil. I was saved by independent relationships I made with conservative Republicans who really saved me. Went in talking to them with my long hair and my earrings and talking hunting, coon hounds, tractors, farms, until they found out that I was not an ideologue, I was not judging them, and they rammed me through the state committees, and then they voted against me on the record to protect themselves from their compatriots. But they saved me, and that's where I first learned about independent relationships. The second thing is, where is your power multiplied? Your power is multiplied on the local level. And what the right wing has been doing for 30 years is electing school board officials, library councils, town councils. That's where we should be working. One of my very good friends who comes to consult with me just ran Tom Steyer's campaign, the political organization. Tom Steyer is the big billionaire like George Soros, who just spent $60 million trying to upend the Koch brothers. I think maybe we won one or two races, you know, top down, going through the political structure again. You will never outspend the corporate sector. So I think that you have to go where you live, and you have to take on the institutions. Who buys the books for your schools? What kind of education are your kids getting to read? What are the science texts? Are they censored by the corporate sector? What about the local public television networks? When their charters come up, are you protecting that they're taking sponsorship from Exxon and Chevron and they're not doing shows about global warming? It's going to be our responsibility. NBC was owned by GE. They were never going to do a show about nuclear waste being under the playgrounds in New Orleans. So it's our responsibility. We all have to be muckrakers. We all have to be warriors. for our environment where we live, because these guys have just sold out. They want to get out with what they put in. They paid their dues, they want to get out, and they figure their kids will figure it out, or technology will figure it out. But they won't, and we're the people living with the wreckage. So I don't have a formula to give you, but I do know that a pyramid is supported by the stones at the bottom. Sorry. Did I scare you? I'm sorry. The pyramid is supported by the stones at the bottom. Obama is supported by the stones at the bottom. Franklin Roosevelt said to the black leaders at the NAACP, make me do it. And the civil libertarians, make me do it. We got Obama, we all went back to blogging. And the only people you saw on the streets were the Tea Party. Is it a wonder that we lost? So I just want to start the colloquy. I don't have the answers. I'm not a political wizard. But I know that this process of being inclusive, respectful, deep listening, as he said, it builds trust, it builds intimacy, and in intimacy, it's possible to say things that you couldn't ordinarily say. I ran a show on Link TV called Outside the Box, and it was an interview talk show. Link TV is a nationwide public television show, and I had one rule. I had conservatives on, I had liberals on, no interrupting. Everybody had a pencil and pen. And you take notes, and when the guy is done, then you go. And if I had to, I gave you a talking stick, and as long as you held it, and they all loved it. And actually, when people are not fighting to get a last word or a quick put down, things settle, and the dialogues get more fruitful. And I think all of those things. I think if you're a Christian, practice Christian meditation. Calm down. Calm your anger. Calm your fear. Learn to talk and listen to people without hysteria. I think that's deep politics. I think that's culture. One more thing I'll say about that. I was a real player in the counterculture. And it's fair to say that we lost virtually every political battle in the counterculture. We didn't end racism. We didn't end war. We didn't end free market capitalism. We didn't end greed. Lost all of them. But we won every cultural battle, every single one. There's no place in the United States today you can't go and find a women's movement, an alternative health movement, acupuncture, naturopathy, homeopathy, massage, Ayurvedic medicine. There's no place that you won't find an environmental movement. In his last book, Paul Hawken took the hundreds of thousands of environmental groups, you know, Save Poota Creek, Save This One, Save That One, and organized them as the largest mass movement in the history of the planet. Collectively, it's like the Prigogine thing again. Food. Everyone is eating organic food. Lots of people have access to it. Slow food. People are savoring good tomatoes and good wine. And they're building a life which is much deeper than politics and which they will defend. So I think it's always on those smallest levels. What's the food you bring home for your children? Why are we buying bottled water instead of demanding that our public infrastructure deliver us pure water? So we're not buying plastic bottles and shipping them all over the country. We don't have to buy raspberries from Israel in February. Mm-hmm. We can buy locally and start to live on a local diet. We're all guilty of that. And so it involves very small acts of stopping our greediness and our selfishness. We don't have to shout at other people. We can start right close to home, because human nature is no nature. It has no inherent form. And you can be Mother Teresa or you can be Hitler. And if you don't know that, you will never be on watch for when Hitler's emerging as a word of anger, giving someone the finger when they cut you off, which is very close to pulling a trigger. So the reason I talk about spiritual practice is we have to know fully what we humans are capable of. And then if you start with yourself, it will be visible to your neighbors. Your kids will be healthier. You'll be saving money on water. You can organize people. And I think that's what I mean by local work. last question. Oh, it's a couple more. Yeah, well, somebody. Yes, you were second. Sorry. No, behind you, this gentleman.
I was wondering what you were talking about. Maybe this is self-evident, but you were talking about all the spiritual practices being helpful to understanding the whole holistic nature of the universe. But unfortunately, in my lifetime, and many people around me have found that so many of the spiritual practices have gone the way of the intellectual side, where they end up dividing people and fighting yeah. people. And whether it be the Christians or the Jews or the Islamic or the Buddhists end up becoming much more divided. Visionary force that
in Burma certainly
a unifying force, or you know, as you say, getting a feeling of this the whole interconnectedness of the universe. And so you know, I think that you know, so much again in Western thought, so much of our spiritual practices have provided evidence of the opposite way, I think.
Indisputably true, but. I just published my second book. It's coming out in April. And in the first incarnation of this book, it was just a horrid political screed. I built a little commie juice soapbox, and I stood on it with a megaphone telling everybody what to do and what was wrong. It was designed to be a stake through the heart of various social laws. And the agent who refused to sell it said to me, you know, you're trying to refute Rush Limbaugh's readers. You've footnoted everything. You've done 2 years in the library. She said, they're not even going to admit your sources. She said, we all write books for our people. And you don't know how big your people are until you write the book. But you're basically writing for people who see the world the way you do. So all I'm saying is, within every religion and every tradition, there are people who see the world the way we do, the way I do, or the way that you're describing. Those are the people you have to start with. The others may come along or they may not. I just wanted to make the claim that there's no religion that is inherently inappropriate for finding people who are conscientious practitioners and believers in some supreme interdependent force that binds us all. But what you say is obviously true on the mass picture. Wait, so this, you, someone here had a hand, yes, you did.
I'm Catholic, meditating, and I keep leaving my body. I have these experiences where I left out, and it's very exciting. It feels very spiritual. But I wondered if many here who meditate get the same thing. And my second question, because I'm Native American, how is Leonard Peltier?
How what?
How is he doing, Leonard
Peltier? Oh, so her two questions were that she's a Catholic meditator, and she often has the experience of leaving her body, and she finds it invigorating and exciting. She wondered if Zen meditators do. And then she asked me about Leonard Peltier. So I'm glad you came back to your body.
If, there were times when I was frightened and I couldn't.
If you don't, we call it dead. I'm glad you were here. And we very often have lots of kind of spooky tooth experiences in Zen. And our teachers tell us, that's nice. It's a clue that you're on the right path. It's not the goal. It's a clue that the tethers that are holding you to a conventional view of reality are softening. Stay in your body. Go away. You'll come back. The force of your life will bring you back. You don't have to worry. But it's not where you want to go. You may go there when you're dead, but right now we need you here on Earth to join the other people of goodwill who are meditators. And you know, Buddhism is not exactly a religion. So I used to meditate with Catholic monks and Methodists and Episcopalians. Buddha was a human being. He was a human being who was obsessed with the problem of suffering. He was not a god, he was not a holy person. And all of those gestures that you see us bowing and lighting incense, those are actually expressions of gratitude for this teaching. but it is warm heart to warm heart. It has always been a human transmission from Buddha through 95 generations to Taigen, to myself, to the next generation. Leonard Peltier is probably going to die in prison. I've been one of his two advisors with Peter Matheson for nearly 40 years. And the government has even come out and claimed finally that they have no idea who killed the FBI agents in the huge war in 1973 on the Sioux Indian Reservation. And had he been convicted of first-degree murder instead of aiding and abetting a crime, he would have been eligible for parole 20 years ago. The fact that he's not is an exercise of illegitimate power on the part of the government. And to date, we've never been free and never been able to free him, but neither have we quit. We think America's better than that. We think any citizen deserves a better trial than that. And the circuit court judge who was forced to condemn him by the law wrote a letter to Clinton begging him for clemency, saying this was not this man's fault.
I wrote a letter too.
Oh, good for you. Anyone? Yes?
Peter, I have one question, both for myself and for the society at large.
Has the society at large given you permission to speak for them?
Maybe. In my own practice, when I wake up in the morning, I pray that all beings fulfill and become compassionate, including ISIS.
Sure,
all beings. And I pray for those who are torturers as well as those who are tortured.
Sure.
And where we get caught in the political cycle is that people will then point to ISIS and say, well, they are doing this and we have to immediately address this. And my own spiritual conflict is, how do I approach somebody like ISIS? I could pray for that they realize their Buddha, quote, Buddha nature and become compassionate. But how do we as a society, because that's always brought up as a foil for us to take actions like we did in Iraq or in other places and wind up, you know, pulling us into this cycle of crisis.
Did you understand his question?
No.
Oh, so he said that when he wakes up in the morning, he prays that people be filled with loving kindness, that they be filled with compassion, that he prays for the tortured and the torturers, that he prays for all beings. That's a Buddhist perspective, that we're all linked. But he says in the short term, there are threats from which we have to protect ourselves. How do we do that? How do you talk to people who are concentrating on the threat aspect and forgetting our linkage? Well, one way is, I think that society as a whole never does anything. It wasn't society as a whole that invaded Iraq. There were millions of people in the streets. I was among them. Taigen was among them, who were predicting very accurately what would happen. There was a cadre of political leaders who crafted a document called the Project for a New American Century, who used the attacks on 9/11 as an excuse to scoop up the oil in Iraq. And they didn't think it through, and they thought it would work and pay for itself, and it wasn't the people as a whole. So I think the only way you can talk to anyone is as an individual. And one thing I try to do, without ever justifying anyone else's violence, but just put yourself in the position of an Iraqi mother. I happened to be on Bill Maher's TV show when we invaded Iraq, when we did the shock and awe campaign. And I said on television, well, that's a war crime. We're bombing an urban center. We're dropping bombs on men, women, and children who have nothing to do with armed conflict. And this woman another guest named Georgette Mosbacher, leapt up and told me to leave the United States. And I said, well, actually, I'm in the United States because it's a country where a person like you can't get up and make me leave. But the point is, it comes from considering yourself the good guys. If you forget the scope of human nature, you will forget that from the point of view of an Iraqi mother, she doesn't care if the good guys are dropping bombs on her children. It makes no difference. And from the perspective of the Palestinians, they don't care that the Jews were given the promised land. And from the perspective of the Jews who are being fired rockets on, yes, those are real threats and they have to be dealt with. But we all tend to exclude our own culpability. We talk about Iran and we start history with the kidnapping of our diplomats. We overlook the fact that the CIA overthrew a democratically elected president to get the oil. We don't want to be part of that history, that we destabilized the country, we gave it to a Shah who had an extravagant secret police of torturers, and people were disappeared and murdered and killed at the behest of the United States, and a whole generation of young people grew up quite angry at us. So Buddhists would say that every action comes from some previous action, and that action comes from something previous. So until we look back at the larger field again, we're never going to understand history. So without making ourselves wrong, I find that sometimes if I'm really relaxed, I can keep going back with, why did they do that? Do you know that we did this? Does that make any difference? Maybe we shouldn't have done that. But it's never the society as a whole. It's your kindness and respect to the person you're talking to that will determine if you're able to make them listen or not. That's what I think. Maybe one more. I feel like I'm taking up the oxygen in the room. Yeah.
Well, I have a comment related to your comment.
Oh, good. Talk to him.
And it's generated by what you're saying, really, that there's an author, I think his name is Shoemaker, and it's called Healing the Wounds That Drive Us to War. And
E.F. Shoemaker.
It's fascinating that, you know, the rhetoric is they, whoever they are, hate us for our democracy, when in fact, that doesn't send people to war. And it's more altruism on their part, if we can wrap our brains around it, that, you know, that somebody's not going to die for the fact that they hate democracy. I mean, that's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, it's like you're not going to get divorced because some gay people get married.
Yeah. And another, I was reading something just this morning about this gentleman, Joel Goldsmith, who wrote a book, Practicing the Presence. And he said, fascinating to him during, he was in Europe during World War I, and that all these churches were getting together and rah-rah, victory, we won victory. And he said what he noticed is that nobody was praying for the other side. They were praying to win, to a god or whomever, to step in and make them win victory over the enemy. But he didn't see any of those same churches praying for the enemy, which is what you, it sounds like you were trying to say you're doing. It sounds pretty good to me.
But you know, one of the problems with all the Abrahamic religions is that they're all based on a duality of good and evil, and we're all forced to choose sides. And actually, experience is not so simple. And one of the things that the big picture affords us, and dropping language affords us, is that we can see things in their particularities. We can see the way they interrelate and work. And so whether it's sports teams, whether it's the fact that everybody likes the surgeon, honors the surgeon, and doesn't pay attention to the nurse, whether you give a football player $25 million for throwing a ball and the teacher of your children can barely support herself, we're operating all these contradictory oppositions where we have to pick one. And I think that's what's letting us down. And I sometimes think that the arrival of Eastern religions has been offering us a kind of antidote to this, even if it's intuited. People are looking at the yin-yang symbol and the black and the white with the white dot and the black dot, and they're kind of saying, yeah, that's the way reality is. That feels more true to me. It's like a better tool. So you don't have to prove somebody else false. You just find that, yes, reality is admixed. Things are not simple. things change every instant. The woman you were angry at 10 seconds ago is a different person. And you need to be able to stop and get a fresh look. Well, she was angry then. Is she still angry? So I'm hoping that all of these practices are going to help us mature as a country. But I know it's not going to happen as a country. It's going to happen as each of us, as individuals, taking account of our own nature. The last thing I'll say is this. I keep talking about the good guys, and I keep talking about the importance of understanding the totality of your nature. That you, somewhere people are eating people, and somewhere people are risking their lives being nurses in the Ebola ward. And everything in between is contained in us. The great Buddhist teacher Thich Nhat Hanh wrote a poem called Please Call Me by My True Names. And he describes a snake eating a frog, and a bunch of interdependent relationships. And then he talks about a pirate in the Gulf of Tonkin who captures a family of immigrants and rapes and kills a six-year-old daughter and throws her into the bay. And then Thich Nhat Hanh says, I'm the frog, I'm the snake, I'm the little girl, and I'm the pirate. And not to understand that you have the potential to be all of it means you won't be on guard when the pirate arises, because you'll be telling yourself, we're the good guys. We're the guys in white hats. Everything we do is good. Not like that. Human nature's half dark and half light. And we like to think that if you take away the dark, you have a human being, but you don't. You don't have a circle without the other half. So we're always going to have this mixed human nature. And what spiritual practice does is help us integrate it and be on guard for our baser impulses, what Buddhism calls beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, just blowing through the radio receivers that we are. So there's a Buddhist teacher, a very famous Buddhist teacher named Tenchin Reb Anderson. And we were talking once 25 years ago when I was somewhat newer to practice. And he said, you know, this idea of being, most people go through life and they comfort themselves by feeling that they're the good guys. And they cause untoward amounts of damage. He said, I find it much safer to consider myself a very, very dangerous person. And he wasn't kidding. And I monitor myself very carefully. And a lot less people get hurt. So I'd like to thank you for being such an attentive audience. And really, it's been a pleasure to be here today. Thank you very much.
I need to say something. I was negligent in my introduction because I did not mention Peter Coyote, as he said, is a writer, and I recommend Sleeping Where I Fall, which is his account of the counterculture, very rich, and his new book coming out next spring, which is called The Rain Man's Third Cure. So I just needed to say that.
Thanks for the plug.